following interview was conducted for the Purdue University Oral History Program. It took place on Friday, April the 27th, 2007. Being interviewed is Professor Felix Haas. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, and it took place in one of the Carrollson Math Library. Welcome. Tell us a little bit about where you were born and your early years.
Well, I came to the United States in 1939, just before the Second World War. I was born in Vienna, Austria, left there in 38, in the summer of 38, and I spent a year in England, essentially waiting for my American visa to get ready, because there was a waiting list at the time. And I came in the fall of 39, I came to the United States, and then in late 42, December 42, I was drafted into the American Army, because non-citizens were subject to the draft if they were permanent residents. And so from 39 to late 42, I had jobs in New Jersey, various jobs. And I worked in a garment factory, and I worked in a smelter for a while. And then I was drafted in the Army, and I was in the Army from essentially January 1st, 43 until I got out in 46, and while I was in the Army, I became a citizen, because when you were in the Army, the process of becoming a citizen was speeded up. So I remember becoming a citizen when I was stationed in Camp McCoy, Wisconsin. It was in some sense an amusing experience, because my two witnesses were my sergeant and my first sergeant. We got to the courtroom, we had to wait for a little while. They felt that they were doing me a favor, had to entertain them. And they took them to the saloon next door. By the time we got back to the courtroom, I was worried about how good a witness it would make, but it worked out okay. I became a citizen. And then I was discharged in 46. And in 46, I never finished high school in Austin. In 46, I applied to MIT, because I had an uncle in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and MIT took me even though I had never finished high school, just on the basis of tests, for which I will always be grateful. From then on, my life was easy. Beginning in 46, my life was easy. I was a student at MIT from 46 to 52, a bachelor's degree in physics, a master's degree in mechanics, and a PhD in mathematics in 52. And then I ended up as a research instructor at Princeton. I was there until 55. That was for a young mathematician, this particular instructorship was the most valued prize. I was called a Henry Burchard Fine Instructor, which was a desirable thing for a young mathematician to do at that stage. While at MIT, I met my wife, Violet, was a graduate student in mathematics, and as a matter of fact, my second wife, who I married after Violet died, introduced me to Violet at MIT. I was in both of them. They were students there in the 40s. And then I taught at Princeton for a while, and then I moved west, late in the campus history, but I moved west, and ended up in Indiana, at Purdue. Accepted a job in the summer of 61, came in January 62. And my first job was head of the Division of Mathematical Sciences.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Could we just go back a little bit? Where were your parents when they came over? Were you living in Massachusetts? Is that your home? Your early years were spent in?
No, I was by myself. Oh. I came over by myself.
Oh, okay. And so do you have any relatives here at all? Or?
My aunt, my uncle and aunt who facilitated my coming to England, then facilitated, they were not responsible for coming to the United States. I had some people give me affidavits of support who were not related to me. But then at that stage, in order to come here, the government wanted assurance that you would not be an indigent. So I had two women gave me affidavits of support, which was considered a formality. I was not going to be depending on that position, and way of getting a visa.
Did you stay with them, or?
No. And had dinner with each of them once. And that was a cope. The dumbies, they're taking a risk to help the young person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I...
But your early years, how old were you when you came over?
I was 18.
Okay.
And I came by myself. At that time, my uncle and aunt were still in England. By the time I came out of the army, they'd come to the United States, in Cambridge.
Okay.
My uncle was a graduate student at Harvard. I thoroughly enjoyed myself as a student.
Sure. When you were in the war, did you serve? Were you in the United States?
I was one of the people that the army placed properly. I took tests and so forth. The army put me into a field artillery battalion to compute firing data. I had mathematical ability, and it was really the right place for me. Because what I did in the army now is done by computers, but in those days you really needed somebody with paper and pencil to figure out in what direction to point the gun and how high to aim it, and to worry about wind velocity, and worry about the temperature and humidity, and introduce those elements into the firing computations. As I said, no, I would be technologically unemployed for that. No prospect or desire to serve in artillery again. And I was with the heavy artillery battalion, which was not a very heroic place to be. I mean, we were usually far behind the land. But we were the first heavy artillery battalion to land in Normandy, which was about 3 weeks after the Normandy landing. After that, I had a sizable beachhead.
Sure.
And we were the Third Army, General Patton's army, and we fought our way all the way to the end of the war to Germany. And then I was...
Then you were discharged, and you came back and...
Yeah, I actually enjoyed myself in the army for a number of reasons. First of all, for me, moving from what I was doing in the Jordan in the army was an improvement in my living standard. And then I was motivated because of Hitler to participate in the war. So it was a very pleasant experience. And I got out in 46, and then went to my penis June 46. And actually, in 6 years, I did a bachelor's, master's, and PhD degree, and got out. And I rushed because I felt old. I felt I had lost time because I had never finished high school. I felt
very close again.
I felt I had to catch up. Now, when I became a dean here in 63, at age 42, I felt I had made up for the time.
Go back to what you started. Then you were when you came. Where had you been prior to coming to Purdue?
I was at Princeton.
Okay.
And when I was from Princeton, I moved as chairman of the mathematics department at Wayne State.
Okay.
And in 61, Purdue had a crisis in the mathematics department. It's ancient history. The department was in a fight with the dean. Half the people, most distinguished people, had left. The department had been transferred from the Center School of Science, Education, and Humanities into the School of Engineering because of that fight. The heads of the engineering schools, a group, went to see President Offley to say something had to be done about mathematics. And so Offley got appointed an outside committee, chaired by a man by the name of Saunders McLean, who knew me. And Sonus McLean told Hofty that I was the right man for this job to take over the mathematics department. And so when I came with a certain amount of bargaining power, and I was promised substantial increases for the department. Actually, I was promised $200,000 a year in increases for 3 years in a row to rebuild the department, but also to worry more about applied mathematics or computing. Hofty was interested in that. Mm-hmm. Am I coming to my
No, no, go ahead. No, that's fine. We want you to hear experiences at Purdue.
Okay,
that's great. Yeah.
And when I came here, so I started rebuilding the department.
Both from a student standpoint as well as faculty?
Well, of course, the two go together.
Sure,
need
right.
To, academic administration consists of three parts. First of all, you have to get the resources for what you're doing. Secondly, you have to use quality control to assure that the resources are not wasted, you get the best possible people. And thirdly, you have to shape the direction of what's happening. And in order to get resources, you have to do a good job for the students and the other departments. So one of the things I did, I was head of mathematics, I went to all the other schools on the campus. I said, what would you like mathematics to do for you? Yeah, because I built a climate where the university was supportive of having mathematics built. And that, I think that's true of every level of administration. You know, if you think of a university as a place, which is a fine university, a place where scholars meet young people for mutual benefit, the definition is true by the philosopher Whitehead, then academic administration provides the resources for that meeting, it uses the quality control, and it shapes the direction.
Okay.
Now, that first year, I hired 21 people. The department. Because I had 21 people, I must have made 80 offers of appointment, of course. And I got some good people for the first year. And then I decided that I really, the department.
And you were in a recitation, that was where they had building. Okay.
But I decided the department was getting too large, and I also felt that the areas of statistics and computer science were sufficiently different from mathematics, that they needed some kind of separate identity. And we then, within a year, formed three departments. Initially, the departments didn't have separate budgets. The budget was still one that the whole division had. But the curricula were set by three different groups of people because they all didn't have competence in all these areas to set curricula. They set a computer science department, a statistics department, a mathematics department. A year and a half later, they were formally made departments by the trustees and got their own projects, but that was the beginning of the first things I did in mathematics. And if I've ever done anything for the university, I've brought good people here, because that's the best thing you can do for a university. I got Sam Compton for mathematics and Shanti Gupta for statistics. They were the right people. As was Guna Kurat, whom I hired later for geosciences. These were very good people, very solid people. You know, decent people, smart people, and even with people. And then, within a year or so after I came here, President Hofty said he wanted to form a new school of science, but I'd like to be dean. And initially I rejected the job because I felt that I hadn't finished my job in mathematics yet.
But having been here just a short period of time, perhaps.
But they came back to me another 6 months later and said again that they wanted a new school and they only wanted it if I was willing to accept the deanship. So I became dean, technically, in June 63, July 1st, 63, the new school was opened. They initially had the departments of physics, chemistry, the biological sciences, mathematics, computer science, statistics. And I think that was a very happy period of my life. I enjoyed being dean. I enjoyed enjoyed the all aspects of the job. I enjoyed dealing with the people, getting good people, and
fundraising?
We did some fundraising, but in all fairness, the amount of fundraising done in universities, private fundraising, has increased tremendously in the last 75 years. Certainly, as late as 1950, public universities did practically no outside fundraising.
They depended on the state.
And gradually this increased. But in some sense, your fundraising is related to a clear vision you have of what you want to do. And, you know, if you know what you want to do, it becomes easy to explain to outsiders where they are to help you. Now, one of the early fundraising efforts here was this particular building in which we're sitting, was a $4.5 million building. Things were cheaper in those days. But I got $1.5 million from the National Science Foundation for the building. Those days, the National Science Foundation still supported buildings. They stopped that program a few years ago.
Continue with the windows. Go ahead.
So we got that building $1.5 million towards the $4.5 million building for National Science Foundation for this building, for the mathematics building, which was completed about 68 or so, I think. And I did some fundraising, and it was really related to what I tried to explain to people what we were doing and why.
What were some of the challenges when you were the dean that you do recall?
Well, I mean, I really had to make some changes. I was unhappy with two of the departments, but they may not name, and I felt that a change had to be made. I found it hard to do this, but I never felt, I always believed that you should not micromanage a university, you leave units alone. If you can't trust the people there what to do, you should make a change in the leadership. You shouldn't interfere. And then another thing was, it became fairly clear that in order for us to play the appropriate role with the science school in the kind of university that Purdue was, we needed some development in the geology, in which we didn't have. And I think it's 68 or 67, I guess. I discussed it with President Hoffman. All the things I've done, if I've done anything, would not have been possible at any stage without the support of the presidents and the vice presidents whom I reported to, who were always sympathetic and friendly. I never found any resistance or anything. And I decided then that the need of the department is general field of the earth sciences. But I didn't want a traditional geology department just concerned with rocks. I have a concept that you want departments to be as large as possible, because the more departments you have, the more barriers you erect between people interacting. So just as the Department of Biological Sciences has a zoology, a botany, and whatever. The department that was then called Geosciences, which is now called Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, they put in the geophysicists, the geochemists, the geologists, the meteorologists, paleontologists, variety of people concerned with the Earth's surrounding atmosphere. And they worked out very well, I think. Mm-hmm. They just had their 40s out of the... They just had their 40th anniversary. I was there. Mm-hmm. And guy brought in somebody named Gunnar Kulerali in 68, who was a marvelous geochemist who really understood what needed to be done. And as I said, I enjoyed all aspect of being a dean. I enjoyed getting the resources, I enjoyed the quality control. I made enemies in my career. They were always over the issue of quality control. When you tell a dean that he cannot keep somebody because the person really isn't good enough for the university, that violates people's ego, and that's the only thing that I said, okay, first making enemies over in the university than anything. And then I particularly enjoyed the interaction with the faculty. I've always thought of myself as a faculty member. I mean, I've been a member of the mathematics department all the time I was here. I've taught a course every year that I've been at, every semester that I've been at Purdue until a year ago. And my roots have remained in the mathematics department. These are my friends.
That's your base. That's right. This is your base.
These are my friends. And so I mentioned earlier that I think I've brought in some very good people. And that's really what you do. You bring in very good people and then leave them alone. Now, sometimes unless they want to interact with you, there are one or two reasons why they interact with you. One is because they want the resources of some endeavor or other. And the other one is because they're looking for father image, or in the case of a mother image. They want to brag to somebody about the success they've had. And some of my fondest memories of deans were when I would sit in my office on the ninth floor and say, Michael Rossman came in and just done analysis of the second variables. And he pointed out that the common sinks, the first and the second variables, and he said, those must go back to the early stage of evolution. You know, I enjoyed that kind of interaction with people. I enjoyed, in order to be a good university administrator, you have to take pleasure in the success of others.
And then you moved on from...
I was department, and I became dean.
Right. Uh-huh.
And then my dean's office originally was in engineering administration until this building was finished. And I worked with minimal administration. I had an associate dean, Bill Fuller, whom you may know. And Bill and I each taught a course. So actually the cost of the School of Science of administration were two-thirds of Fuller and two-thirds of me. That was the total administrative cost, plus some secretaries. And I've always believed in minimal administration. You want to keep administrative costs down. That enables you to have resources for hiring good people and supporting them. And I pursued this, for instance, when I was provost. I put the School of Nurses under the same dean as the School of Pharmacy and the School of Health Sciences. I didn't want three deans. I wanted a minimum number of administration to save cost. That's
good point. How did you get the? That's that when Hansen came, isn't that correct? When you were the provost, did they come to you, or how did that come about?
Yeah, well, Hansen first brought us in a man named Robinson from North Carolina.
Right.
And there were some difficulties with Robinson. And then Hansen asked me to become provost. And that was a very rewarding experience. The trick for being a provost is to know what decisions the president wants to make and what decisions he doesn't want to be involved in. And if you have a modicum of sensitivity, it's usually not too hard to tell. And then you take to the president those things where you think they expect that he would want to make the decision. The rest, you don't bother him. And I think I worked very well with Hansen. I also worked very well with the business office, actually. I'm not one of those who blames the business office for all the problems. I think that it's the job of is to excite the business offers over the things that you want to do academically. If you convince them that what you want to do is going to build a great university, it's going to be good for the university, they'll go along with it.
Exactly.
And,
when the provost, you had all, that was like the over all the academic department.
Yeah, the provost essentially. And
for the researcher, just explain the.
Yeah, the President Hansen essentially everything reported either to Fred Ford or to myself. Now the few of the exceptions was intercollegiate athletics that reported directly to the president and a few other things, but all other units. So I had to, was responsible for the schools, the libraries, the computing centers, the regional campuses.
The regional campuses as well.
Yeah, I was responsible for the regional campuses.
Okay.
And I think John Hicks was responsible for legislative relations, reported directly to the president, and also private fundraising, reported directly to the president. It was for the succession of vice presidents for development. And I think that probably this is a pretty good setup. Probably the president should have three people report to him. Somebody on the academic side, somebody from the fiscal side, and somebody responsible for the outside world, fundraising, the legislature, and so forth. And I think that each of them is supposed to push in their direction, the direction of what they're supposed to represent. And the president can make up his mind which way he's going to go. That worked very well,
let me just ask a question. The regional campuses, did they grow during that time? And
they grew. I'm not convinced that the regional campus system is good for the state of Indiana. I think that 70 years ago, Indiana and Purdue started these regional campuses. I'm not sure that, from the point of view of the public, a strong system of junior colleges where people are fed into all the main campuses
a feeder.
Wouldn't be better, where you have essentially three research campuses by now, Indianapolis, Bloomington, and Lafayette, some major teachers' colleges, Ball State and Indiana State, and then the system of junior colleges. Mm-hmm. The state of California has a system like this, that the university system, the state college system, and the junior college system.
Very, very large.
And it works reasonably well, I think. But we now have the regional campuses, and so they work quite well.
And
they're doing a lot of good things for the people.
And they've grown a lot.
They've grown more really since I stepped out, I think. They've grown more recent years. And I think in fact, of course, now some of the junior college functions being taken over by Ivy Tech. So I think the system's in relatively good shape. But I think Indiana has still a low percentage of its high school graduates go to college. And I would look at this as the problem, that we don't really have a well-developed system of junior colleges that feeds people into the other places.
Yeah.
I think, at least. And then I became provost in 74, and I was dean for 12 years from 62 to 74, and then provost from 74 to 86. Then I retired and went back into the Department of Mathematics.
Okay. And you've been doing some teaching? Tell us what you've been doing some teaching since?
Yeah, I taught I was on the faculty until 81, officially. And then I was 70 and I had to retire. I retired 70. But I continued teaching a course a semester as a volunteer because I just liked the kids. And then I think that in that sense I think I was a good fit for Purdue because I had been a student at MIT and I like engineering students. I like the kind of kids we get here. We are students in the Ivy League school sort of think of themselves as an elite. They're arrogant, you see. We get some very bright kids, although they know that they're very bright, who come from small town. And engineering typically is a profession that does not attract the children of the very rich. It's a profession that attracts lower middle class kids. And I like working with lower middle class kids. They're very pleasant and very interesting.
Yeah.
And I've taught everything in mathematics. When I first came here, I taught all kinds of graduate courses where we didn't have anybody in that field.
Has the graduate enrollment increased since you've been over time since you've been here, do you find?
Yeah, it has gone up, but no. But the graduate enrollment, my guess, has not grown as much percentage-wise as the undergraduate enrollment. I don't know the numbers offhand, but I think that's the case. But we get some very good graduate students in Purdue also.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, got any favorite memory of Purdue that you'd like to share with us? Or long time, or outstanding, or something, for the researchers, it might be. I think you've addressed some of them. You would like working with all
I like
areas.
Working with people, and I like, and I hope that I made some good decisions. Those would be gratifying, of course. When I was provost, we worked with, I worked with some very good people again, with Don Brown and Bob Klinko and Straza Ahmad. But I always surrounded myself, and maybe this comes back to something I said earlier, I always surrounded myself when I was provost with people with a base, an academic base. I mean, when I had Bob Klinko and Straza Ahmad, they're vice presidents, but they still had research support in their own departments. And the virtue of this is that when you have people have a base, they can say no to you. They'll be frank because they don't have to be afraid of you. And I think this is I was just recently read a book about Peter Drucker, and he emphasized, I was surprised what he said was about industry. But it's really true in university too, that the only people really worth having are people who need you less than you need them. And those people are going to be independent, they're going to tell you the truth. But that's how you get good ideas, because very often, you know, you talk to people and you eventually adopt their view. And actually this works out very well. When you adopt your view, you win in two ways. First of all, you now have a good idea. But secondly, they are pleased when they hear you express the views that they first gave you. It works out very well. And I learned from all these people who surrounded me, I suppose.
Right.
Darlene Hine is another one I remember with a very fine historian.
Right. And you worked with Bob, with Dr. Ringel?
General Ringel quite well.
Yes.
Luther Williams, I don't know if you remember him, he was a biologist.
Associate
provost, and then went on to become a graduate dean at Washington University in St. Louis, and then the vice president of Colorado, and then became the university president.
It's nice to follow their, the threads.
The impact you make is on the institution, but also on people. And I'm not sure what's more fun, really, the
the people who you feel that you have helped along the way, or the institute, whatever you have done for the
But sometimes you get a more lasting feeling from that, you know, as it sort of goes through you. You reminisce and you think about it. And interact.
Let me ask you another thing.
The hall was named after you. How did that come about? Were you surprised?
Well, I was very surprised, and I was very gratified that the president called me, said they want to name a building after me, and as I said, I was surprised, but secondly, I was very pleased with it. I can't pretend I'm not pleased with it.
Right.
And I enjoyed it. And when I've been in dedication, my three children came and their families. And
where do your children live?
Well, unfortunately, they're all far away. They are, one is in Massachusetts, one is in New York, one is in New Jersey. For a long time, I had one in San Francisco, which I liked. Because I like visiting San Francisco, but that's no longer the case.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, much of what I did was related to my late wife, Violet, who was a professor of electrical engineering. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of the impact we had of the institution, it was really a joint impact, not just my impact, I think.
Right.
And,
did any of your children go into academe at all?
No. Actually, two of my children got PhDs, but they're not working in universities. The third one is a doctor physician. The one in Massachusetts is a physician.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's nice.
All my children wanted to be different from their parents. I think that's true of most children. Since most their parents have been in sort of quantitative scientific endeavors, they want to be different. But they all then found out that their genes were stronger than their rebellion, so they ended up in such a qualitative term.
Interesting.
My younger son is a PhD engineer from Berkeley, who's in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Has a very nice family. And
so you have some grandchildren.
I have seven grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And my daughter got a PhD at MIT from Sloan, the management school in economics, joint degree in economics and management, and she first joined a consulting company and became the first woman partner at McKinsey Company.
Okay.
And then she became a woman partner in the New York office, first in the Cleveland office, and became a woman partner in the New York office. And then she got married after I did the second time. When Violet died, my daughter said, "Dad, then I can live by myself, but you can't. You have to get married again." But then, she got married too eventually. And then she had the whole consulting company and then eventually sold it. And, writing books now and doing other things.
Okay.
I'm raising two children. Yeah.
Have you done any traveling at all since you in your retirement?
Well, I've been in recent years. I haven't done any traveling except
mm-hmm.
to visit the children, and we like Door County in Wisconsin. And I've gone up there. I didn't go up this year, but until this year, I went up every summer to Door County, which I consider the most beautiful place within 700 miles from Lafayette. If you go beyond 700 miles, you have Barrancas and stuff.
Good point.
I've gone there every year. But probably it's getting quieter for me. I'm 86.
Anything that I didn't ask that you'd like to share in closing? Anything that you've thought that you think about? I think you covered it very well, your experiences.
Well, I may just want to say that I mentioned to you earlier that you have to have a clear vision of what you're doing.
Right.
And when I was provost, and this was the vision that I shared with Dr. Hansen and Fred Ford, we thought of Purdue as a distinguished, technically biased Land Grant University. And that means defining. A university needs to have strong humanities and sciences, otherwise you're not a university. The core has to be strong. When you say technically biased, you know, for instance, in England you have Cambridge and Oxford. Cambridge is the technically biased one, they have the Cavendish Lab and so on. Oxford is more traditional oriented. So technically biased university. University of quality, that means. Land grant means that you do not just serve the top 5 or 10% of the population. It's different from MIT or Caltech. Our job is to serve a large fraction of the population.
Right.
And technically bias means that you don't have, only means it refers to professional programs, not the core programs. You don't have professional programs in all the social sciences. You don't have a school of social work or stuff like that. On the other hand, you have a full array of professional programs in the technical fields. And, I mean, that was my vision of the university.
Very good.
And my goal was, you know, when I was provost, my goal was to be, I had goals for different parts. In agriculture, I thought we should be the best, we're trying to be the best Midwestern university. In the humanities, I felt we should be as good, we should aim to be as good as anybody in the Big Ten. That was the goal, to be like Wisconsin or Michigan. In science, my goal was to be second best to the University of Chicago in the Midwest. And in engineering, my goal was to be as good as anybody in the Midwest. So I had specific goals that fit the mission that I saw for the university. And I think when you have that, and you're open about it, you tell everybody about it, it helps in dealing with the faculty, it helps with fundraising, it helps in the relations with the various people you're dealing with. If you yourself are not clear what you want, you can't explain it to anybody.
That's right, exactly.
And
good point.
And
very good.
I didn't succeed in a number of things, but I tried.
You did, right. Okay, thank you very much. This concludes it.